Life is an adventure. What's your story? Well, I'll tell you what. Janet Keeler is here with us today. She has quite a story. I loved reading Janet when I lived in San Diego. She was one of my favorite food and travel writers. She was with the Tampa Bay Times. She has had so many incarnations as a reporter. Now she is the journalism instructor and student news publications advisor at Eckerd College, and her students have won all kinds of awards. So welcome, Janet.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, let's not start at Eckerd. Let's go a little back. Tell us a little bit about your journey as a journalist and where it took you.
Well, I started quite a long time ago, before I really knew there was such a thing as food journalism. I learned how to cover cops and cover courts and cover city hall and education and that kind of thing. But always I was interested in this idea of cooking, and it took me a long time to realize, oh, there's actually journalists who do this, because it was really kind of came about in the 80s, really, I think, food journalism, and then took off from there. The 90s might have been kind of the heyday.
Yeah, like Sevre magazine,
oh, yeah.
And all of those, right?
Yes, right, for sure. And there was all kinds of stories being written about food, not just here's how to cook Thanksgiving dinner, though I did a lot of that.
yes. But you actually elevated this, and you actually taught food journalism at USF as well. Tell us a little bit how you see this food journalism. Now we've got, you know, reporters really on the business of food, like Laura Riley. Tell us a little bit how it's transformed.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I don't think there's a freestanding newspaper food section in the state of Florida anymore. The Times was the last one, and that's been gone a few years. But rather than kind of lament that all this has gone away, I sort of look at all these new opportunities. You know, when I was coming up, someone had to pay you to do it. Now you can start your own business. You can have a blog, you can have a newsletter, you can start a podcast. So you can really, you're not necessarily going to get that check every 2 weeks, but you can start your own business and make a name for yourself without waiting for someone to pay you.
And, you know, that's true. When you look at Eater,
yes.
And, you know, our very own Lori Brown and Kevin, who do
St. Pete Foodies.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of, we are a culinary town. Let's talk about the culinary coast. When you first came here to report, was there as much ethnic food? Was there as much food diversity? I mean, what was it like then versus now?
Well, it was terrible.
I was here in 1999. It was terrible.
And I came in 92 from Northern California, and I was here for a couple of weeks and thought, what have I done? But I was only going to be here for a couple of years and then go back.
Sure you were.
You know, to the Golden State and everything, but I got married and got a dog and got a kid and got a house, and here we are, 32 years later this
yes,
year.
Yes, but you married a photographer, Scott Killer, who's one of the most fabulous photographers in the country.
And he's a good husband, too, and we did a lot of great work together, so that was a lot of fun. But I'll tell you a funny story. When I first came here, I couldn't find fresh mozzarella anywhere. And so there was a restaurant way up 4th Street called Anna's Pasta. And it's long gone. And they used to do a caprese salad. So I would order it and say, don't put any dressing on it. And I would take it home and then take the mozzarella off of it. So yep. We've come a long way.
There were no cheesemongers back then.
Sometimes when I'm downtown, I kind of blink twice and say, where am I?
Yeah,
it's
really.
It's very exciting.
It is.
The things that are going on. It's
hydroponic
really
gardens, right?
Yeah.
What about the international flair of this city? Talk to me a little bit about how, from your time when you came here to write about food to now, what you see developing.
I see a lot more Mediterranean food, I will say that. And I do see, some more Asian. A lot of people would say we need more different kinds of Asian, you know, not just maybe Thai or Japanese or Chinese, but we need, you know, more Korean or more
Malaysian.
And even more Indian, I think. There's some Indian, but even more of that.
Oh, we need more Indian.
Yeah, you can never have enough Indian food.
Cannot have enough curry, right?
Right.
There's a real emphasis today on sustainable foods. This was something always that you wrote about. You were always interested in this. Tell me a little bit how this trend has changed in the years that you've been eyeballing the scene.
Well, I think people are still really interested in it, but I'm wondering, you know, I've always wondered, like on a broad spectrum, do people want to pay for it?
Big issue.
Yeah, and you mentioned Laura Riley, and she did that great series a few years ago, Farm to Fable, about, you know, menus that were not quite telling the truth, you know, because she would know that they're not getting this stuff locally because it's not in season for this. And guess what? We don't grow kiwi in Florida unless someone's got a boutique farm somewhere. So we're kind of susceptible to getting taken a little bit by the stories.
Do you still cook a lot?
Yeah, I do. I do.
What is the, so I think home cooking has become, during COVID and now, there's just a real resurgence of this. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, I think during COVID, you're right. People cut, everybody and everybody was making sourdough bread. And I thought, what is with the, I went to the store, I thought, I'm going to make bagels. I haven't made bagels in a long time. And so it's the most complicated stuff, not just like a little loaf of bread, but let's make something.
Did you actually make bagels?
Yeah, well, I used to do that a lot back in the day. And I couldn't get yeast. I thought, what is going on? I had to go online and find it through some, black market source or something. But everybody was cooking. I think some of that has stayed with us, that people do learn how to cook and enjoyed it. But I do think that no one's cooking 7 nights a week.
No one.
There's just so many things, so many places to get food.
Well, and I'm a 3-ingredient girl like you are. I mean, the less ingredients, the better. And I did just discover Bagel Babe in the Foodies Lab.
Mm-hmm.
She makes actually real bagels, but mm-hmm. I am very impressed that you made bagels. So fast.
They never look very good, though. I'm like, oh, they don't look as pretty as the one in the bagel shop, but
You should see my challah. It doesn't look very good either. So tell me a little bit about how you decided, not only were you a terrific writer, but now you were going to mentor and instruct journalism. Share a little bit about that change.
So I think it was about 2000 and maybe 10 or maybe 8 actually, and the newspapers were starting to fall on hard times, and I thought, maybe since my husband was a photographer at the paper, maybe one of us should diversify. I think it'll be me. So I went and the joke was I was either going to start a homemade marshmallow business or I was going to get my master's degree. And he was like, why don't you get your master's degree? I was like, oh, okay. So I could practically see USF St. Pete from my desk. So I would run over there and take classes and come back. And I got my master's degree and they let me teach a few classes. And I thought, this is kind of cool. So then I eventually switched over to that. I liked it a lot. And I thought it was probably a smart move because of, since two of us were at newspapers and neither of us had ever been laid off, but that didn't seem like it was not impossible, because a lot of people were and continued to be.
So, fast forward to the LA Times just a few weeks ago, hundreds of our friends in California gone.
Yeah, exactly.
So what do you tell your students? I mean, now you're teaching 10 uh-huh. years of university teaching.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
First of all, I want to just, would you tell us about your students who just nabbed a couple of Apple Awards?
Sure. This was from the College Media Association. They just had their annual conference up in New York, and they the students at Eckerd are now putting out a really nice, once a semester, real beautiful glossy magazine called Cat 5. There you go. We know what that means in Florida. So a lot of energy. That's what I always say. They won second place in their smaller college division. And then we had a student who won first place in columns for a really, really nice piece she did. They have a little saying, it's like Austin, Texas, keep Austin weird. They like to say that at Eckerd, keep Eckerd weird. And she talked about, it's just not weird enough. Are we accepting neurodivergent thinkers? And she told her story about having autism, and it was really, really a good piece. I was very glad to see it recognized.
It's just wonderful that you have, I mean, Eckerd College, first of all, under Jim Manarelli, is just an amazing place. It's a campus with arts and performing arts. I don't think people realize there's opera there. There's all kinds of things going on. But the students all have a mission. They all have to go out into the community as part of their four-year degree. Tell me a little bit about teaching journalism and mentoring the students to go into what is a not very robust field anymore.
Well, it's an interesting mission. And at Eckerd, they have a journalism minor. They don't have a major. So all of them have these really great majors. Many of them are animal studies, marine biology majors. Some of them are business majors. Some kind of make up their own major. Oh, I have one that's, in fact, the one that just won, I think she's ancient studies.
Is that Marley Hellerstein?
Yes, yeah, Marley Hellerstein, yes. And she's also fluent in Chinese and very interesting students. I have a lot of students like that there. So I teach them to use journalism as a way to communicate in their fields because many of them are sort of science-oriented, academic-oriented. Not that journalism can't be an academic pursuit, but we're writing so that people can really understand us and taking tough information or complicated information. So that's kind of what I focus on that.
Love that because Carl Sagan was my professor at Cornell and he was a visible scientist. And what you're saying now is exactly what he said, which is we need to be able to communicate about science, technology, climate change, the stars. So you're basically empowering everyone to be able to tell a story. Tell us a little bit about what you share with them in your classes.
Before I say that, I was just going to say, too, I also look at it for them as a little bit of media literacy, because they don't really understand, you know, they've grown up in this, you know, hashtag fake news. You know, they're only 19, 20 years old, so they've really grown up in this era of how can you trust anybody? So I try to at least show them what journalists do, and they're actually quite surprised when we go through the big Society of Professional Journalists code of ethics. They're like, what? There's a code of ethics? I don't know what they think we're doing out there. Yes, we do have ethics. So they don't know, though. You know, they just don't know. They don't come from those worlds. So I think that's a really great thing to teach, too.
And, you know, Poynter, I don't think many people realize that the Poynter Institute right. is here. And, of course, you've been involved with Neil Brown and all of those people. You know, there's propaganda as we go into the political election. What are you teaching your students to really be aware of as they become part of the reporting process?
Well, I try to make sure that they know when they're consuming news that they know the source. They know something about the source. And then we kind of go through ways you can maybe guess that it's not really that great of a source.
I'd like to know
that. Well,
then.
there's you know, the byline is a first name. You know, the author just has, there's nothing about the author. It repeats itself a lot. But then now I'm starting to think, well, I think that's probably AI. Too, on top of it, you know, so those kinds of things. So we talk a lot about that. The one thing I tell them to think about when they're looking at stories, like who's not in the story, whose voice is not in the story, and we see that a lot. We go through stuff that, like, the stories all last year. So many stories about banned books in elementary schools and high schools, middle schools, libraries. I said, whose voice isn't in there? And it takes them a while to realize there's no voices of young readers in there, because they're a little harder. You know, because they think, oh, maybe you can't because it's illegal to talk to them without the permission of their parents. I said, well, not necessarily. It's just harder. You have to find them. And somebody said, well, you know, maybe what they say shouldn't be that important because they're young. And I was like, well, it should be kind of the opposite, actually, because they're the ones that are really affected by this. So, yeah, maybe they don't say things in a sophisticated way or something, but they still deserve to talk about it.
There's a lot of discussion. Jeremy Kaplan over at CUNY has a wonderful newsletter that comes out about how to use. He is advocating AI and use in journalism. What are some of the caveats you're telling your students about, and how are you allowing them to use AI for research, for interviews, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, it's a very interesting thing that has happened. Like this time last year, because ChatGPT was just really in our sights, everybody was like, the administrators, they're not allowed to use it. They can't use it. Put it on your syllabus. Don't look at it. Pretend it doesn't exist. And I thought, well, okay, well, that's not really going to work. And this year, it's a lot more, what can you use it for?
What
can
we
use it for? Ideas. Sometimes they use it for ideas. Can they use it for to check their work? They have found that if they actually ask it to write a story about something, it's not very good. I'm sure it'll get there. But right now, it's not very good. There's a lot of repetition. There's a lot of incorrect information. The more specific you are with it, it seems like the worse it is.
Have you used it in writing anything?
No. I've only used it to show them kind of what it could do. Like, we used it to, I said, if you wanted to do a story on what businesses hire people that have tattoos. That's always a good topic.
Oh, that's a good one for AI.
And so it actually was kind of a cool story. This was last year, and it told you, but it doesn't have any sources in it, though. It's just information. Mm. But if you were writing a story like that, it would certainly kind of give you some categories. Like, it talked about the entertainment business and those kinds of things. And then we flipped it, what kind of businesses wouldn't hire you. And it was all like, you know, and I don't even know if it's true. Banking, you know, the serious kind of money things. But I don't know if that's true, really. I mean, maybe you can't have a dragon on your face, but...
No, but I love that you're actually asking these questions and guiding them through this, because, you know, it seriously, as a journalist right now, I'm hesitant to use it in research. The fact that you don't know the sources,
yes,
isn't that the big issue?
Well, yes, and I think the New York Times recently sued OpenAI, saying you're using all our stuff. They're scraping things off the internet and putting these stories together, so they're stealing stuff to start with.
I believe that our friend Bill DeYoung, well-respected journalist, mm-hmm. at AP Catalyst, we wrote a story, interviewed our fearless leader, president, and the next thing we know, there was an AI version of the story. It's just amazing. So
that same night.
The same night.
Yeah.
The exact same night.
Wow.
T- tell me a little bit about how you love doing it. I can tell that you're passionate about it. And I've seen you, you know, I've seen you in all your iterations, leading the fray, you know, your books, Cookie-licious, all this great stuff. You really love teaching.
You know, I do. I do. I like it a lot. And I'm one of those teachers that, you know, they sometimes they text me in the middle of the night because they're awake, or they email me and then I'm awake and I text back or something. They're like, oh, gosh, you're still awake. Don't expect that from everybody. But no, I do. I do. And I care a lot about them. And I find it interesting just to spend time with it. For one thing, it kind of keeps you young a little bit anyway, you know, is kind of aware of what's going on. And at Eckerd especially, it's a very inclusive, interesting, and diverse place. So I've learned a lot in 3 semesters about gender issues and identities and stuff. And I think that's great. I think that's really good. And you get to know, like last year we had, on the paper, we had a few trans students and we had some teary nights. You know, they were scared and, you know, wow, you come face, these are real people.
Absolutely.
This isn't a campaign thing. These are real people that are struggling with things. And, you know, as a journalist, we're interested in those things.
Absolutely. I mean, honestly, is there a book in your future? Are you, I know that you love to write, and it's nice to take a break from writing, but are you working on something for yourself?
No, I should be, though.
I hope that
you have an idea.
Yes, I actually hope that you do a memoir on how to teach. You know, this could be an extinct profession.
Yeah. You mean teaching journalism?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, because some places are dropping their journalism majors because they're you can't get jobs, but you could transform it a little bit to something else. I mean, we need communication.
That's exactly right. So L.L. Kirshner was here today, and she talks a lot about storytelling. I think what you've told me today is how do we get people to tell stories that are authentic, that are well-sourced, and about whatever topic. So Jalapur, right? Jalapur, mm-hmm. and what she writes for The New Yorker.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to see you do that, and that universities would use that. High schools would use it. And not just high schools, but at even early ages. Tell me how reporting allows you to control your world and find the truth. I want to ask you that question. How is being a reporter?
Well, that's not just my premise for my book. You're actually asking.
Yeah, I'm actually asking because...
Tell it again. Say it again.
here's the thing. Asking questions, learning about other people, telling their stories. How does it transform your life? And how is it important that, like StoryCorps, we keep these stories in the world and illuminate them?
Well, I mean, when you're looking at all this AI, it kind of shows the importance of being human and connecting with each other. Lane DeGregory from The Times, she has a cool thing. She has, it's like 30 questions to carve out character. And it's a bunch of questions about like, who would you want at your funeral? To what's in your purse? You know, things like that. So I use those in class. Thank you, Lane, for that. And I was asked them, what 2 questions would you want to answer and what do you not want to answer? And they're young, so they don't really want to talk a lot about your first experience with death. Who would be at your funeral? But I paired up with a student last week, and she didn't want to be asked that question, who would be at your funeral? And she started, and I said, why don't you want me to ask you that? That was my sneaky way of asking it. And she started saying some things, and all of a sudden she just looked at me, and she said, I can't believe how emotional I'm getting, and started crying. And she said, I'm really embarrassed. And I said, well, please don't be embarrassed. And I said, I don't want to make you feel bad, but if we just separate ourselves a little bit from the conversations and think about this as interviewing, you said something to me and I didn't back away. I didn't say, okay, we won't talk about that anymore. I just kind of took a deep breath, said, do you want to keep talking? Should we do this? Should we do that? I gave you the power.
Safe space.
Yeah, to keep going. And I said, just forget it was me and you, and it was a personal thing, but as an interview tech, you don't want to back away, and they're very big on that because they don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. They don't want to have people cry, make people cry. And I said, well, we really don't want to make people cry. No, we don't do that. But we would like to have real conversations, and sometimes people do get emotional about things. It was really, I told her later, I said,
that was an epiphany.
A really special moment for me that you did that. I know it was hard, and it was very special that you did that and trusted me. She said, well, I didn't know I was going to do that. And I said, well, that's the, you know, the beauty of interviewing, too, if you slow down and let someone talk for a minute.
You know, memoir is such a big thing these days. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we know that there's a number of people teaching memoir. What's your advice to people to take what you're doing at the university if they want to write their memoirs as they look at their legacy project? You've been a great reporter all your life. What's your advice to those listeners on Radio St. Pete who have a story to tell and write?
Well, I would say do it first. I mean, whether you're just, pick up the, you're recording it, you're talking into your phone or something, just start going and start with the stories and stuff. I also think it would be good, even though it's your memoir and it's about you, can you get outside yourself and interview people about you? Like if you still have family left or, parents or, even grandparents or just brothers and sisters. I remember this thing that happened when we were little. Do you remember it that way? I mean, that's kind of fascinating. And then not just like, and then I did this and then I did that. Because you have to have more context than that, I think.
Absolutely. What are you doing with your, I assume that as most professors, you get a summer off. Do you get a summer off, and what will be your summer adventure as a writer and a liver of life? I know you've done a lot of traveling.
Well, this is our 30th wedding anniversary in April.
Congratulations.
And so we are taking the auto train to Washington, and we're spending a month up in the Northeast. We're going to visit some people. We're going to go to, some different people and just visit up there. We've never done anything like that. So
that is exciting.
Yeah, or crazy. I don't know.
That's auto train is kind of fun.
But I'm teaching a class this summer. I haven't done this before. They have a 3-week session they call Autumn Term, which always makes me giggle just a little because autumn in August in Florida.
Autumn,
but
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
So it's a 3-week term. All freshmen go. And they have to go. And I'm teaching a class called Planet on a Plate, Soul Food, Spring Rolls, and Sofrito. And so we're going to look at each week, like food that from soul food, and then the next week it'll be Asian food, and then the next week food from Latin America.
I want you to come back and talk about this.
Yeah, the idea is that we're going to look at how immigration, migration, and slavery has shaped the cuisine of America. So I think it's going to be fun.
Okay, so you heard this first on Radio St. Pete. Janet Keeler is going to come
pending.
Back. Oh, yeah. That is fabulous. Boy, that was a mouthful. You want to repeat that one again?
It's called Planet on a Plate, Soul Food, Spring Rolls, and Sofrito.
I hope that will be a lecture that the public can attend.
Yeah, that would be fun.
I think that would be lovely. I want to thank Janet Keeler for being here today. Not just a journalism instructor and student news publication advisor at Eckerd College, but an incredible, inspired writer and someone whose stories have made a difference in not just my lives, but I'm sure all of yours. Thank you, Janet.
Wow. Well, thank you very much. It's been very fun to talk about all this stuff with you.